Hi Rainmakers, Davinia here, and if you haven't already seen, my brand new book, Cash's Queen, is out now online and in all good bookstores. Cash's Queen was written exclusively for preteen and teenage girls, with a real emphasis on helping the next generation of young women establish positive money habits and achieve full mastery of their finances at an early age. As a mother of two young daughters, Cash's Queen was a real labour of love, and I hope will have a lasting impact on future generations by helping them tackle some of the financial inequalities that continue to plague us as women. Buy it for your daughters, your nieces, your goddaughters, your friends, and even yourselves. Link to find out more and buy your copy is in the show notes. Enjoy the episode. Hi, and welcome to the Let's Make It Rain podcast. I'm your host, Davinia Tomlinson. This podcast is for the rainmakers, those women who are breaking down walls, building their own empires, defying convention and rejecting stereotypes. Women who are unafraid to have open, honest conversations about money among friends and to share the truths we've been told to keep secret. Don't forget to subscribe, share, and download wherever you usually get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, then please leave us a 5-star review. Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of the Let's Make It Rain podcast. Today, I'm pleased to be joined by Kerry Griffiths. Kerry is founder of lifestyle financial planning firm Willowbrook. Kerry, thank you so much for being here with us today. Why don't you introduce yourself for the benefit of the listeners?
Thanks, Davinia. So I'm a financial planner and I work exclusively with women who are divorcing CEOs. So really niche in what I do, and I have built a firm with really clear mission and vision. And what I'm all about is making sure that we remove the financial vulnerability and disadvantage that divorcing women so often face. And my vision of the future is one where it's easy and attractive for women to be money savvy.
I love that. I particularly like the elimination of financial vulnerability, particularly at a time as I speak as someone who is divorced and has been through that whole, you know, you've got the emotional turmoil and then you've got all of the financial upheaval as well. And I think it's easy as women, you know, you get caught up in so many other things, understandably, and it's easy for the finances to really just fall by the wayside. So we're going to dive into some of those issues, hopefully, during the course of this discussion. But before we get there, Kerry, how did you, because you're very specific in who you work with, and we'll talk about that, but how did you become a chartered financial planner in the first place? Was that something you were always destined to become?
No, but it is, I think, in hindsight, destined. But it wasn't like I set out to be a financial planner, although I do believe every step you take takes you on the journey that you're meant to go on. Mm-hmm. So I was the type of child who always felt like I needed to be as good as the boys in the room, very much so from a really young age. And I had some really good academic results, and I had perceived that the way that I was going to be as good as the men was to pursue the topics that they pursued and the ones that are traditionally considered more difficult. So I did a maths degree, not because I was passionate about maths, but because I could and because I was trying to prove myself. Mm. And then from there, a bit of traveling and then into a career in financial services, and very much just looking always at the men in the room and trying to be as good as them. So there was a real part of my journey where it was about proving myself. So that's how I ended up chartered, because there wasn't the need to be chartered. That's actually one of the highest levels of qualification you can have. I'm actually fellow, so I took it beyond that. But the whole reason that I did that was to prove I could do it, because I was as good. And actually from there, that was probably leading up to my 30s, early 30s. And then I think you become like, I can feel myself just relaxing as I said that then. When I hit my 30s, I just became much more self-confidence. I'm much more aware of what was important to me. And I heard a phrase on International Women's Day, which was equality is not sameness. And it really changed my perspective on things. And I had then kind of reassess the approach that I'd taken to life and really think about what is important to me and how I want to live and what I want to do. And that is kind of where Willowbrook then came from.
Mm. Oh my gosh, everything you said there really resonates, particularly, I mean, there are a number of different gems in there, but you know, your point about wanting to prove yourself, I'm sure is something that many of us as ambitious, you know, professional women can definitely relate to. This idea that for me, it was, you know, pursuing a slew of professional qualifications. If there was a professional qualification to do, I was going to do it because I felt that that in some way validated me in the workplace, and not necessarily in comparison with men, but just in general, I felt that, you know, I have to be viewed as credible. I have to be viewed as authoritative, and me being able to, you know, reel out this CV that had just become a scroll of all of these qualifications, that is the one way for me to feel like I belong here. And it's really interesting, this transition that we go through as we get older for lots of us. And I hear this particularly from women. It'd be interesting to get men's take on it, but particularly for women, as we enter into our 30s, and then, as in my case, and entering into 40s, you just don't care as much, do you? You know, it's much more important about your personal fulfillment than validating the opinions and expectations of everyone else.
Yeah, certainly. Now I'm in my 40s and I do genuinely not give a damn.
Yeah, I was trying to, I had to think very carefully then, because I had another word than damn, but yeah, let's stick with damn. But you really don't give either my word or your word at all as you get older, which is brilliant. So, and then thinking about Willowbrook, which I love, and the one of the things that I love most about it is how specific you are about who your audience is. And I think for me, as someone that, you know, had to dodge a bit of criticism, not a huge amount of criticism, but certainly some constructive feedback, if you like, about Raincheck and Raincheck's audience when I first began. And then over time, being even more laser focused on not just Raincheck being about helping women take control of their financial futures, but then even more specifically, it's a certain kind of woman that Raincheck suits best and who will get the most value from it. I think that's really important. It's not just about me shoving this service at any woman in the UK or around the world. It's about making sure that they are the right fit so that we get the best from one another. And for you, you're very clear about the kinds of women who are married to the kinds of men that you are best able to serve. Can you talk to us a bit about that, please?
It's a big journey. So I recognise what you say when you said that you had to dodge quite a lot of other people's opinions.
Yes.
So I, before I started Willowbrook, so Willowbrook started in October 2019, I was working in a role where I was a coach and mentor for other financial advisors within a FTSE 100 company. So I made the decision, something happened in work, and we probably won't get into that, but my audience know a little bit about this. So something happened in work and I made the decision that, like, this is it. And I'm leaving and I'm going to set up my own firm. And I knew that what I was going to do was going to be for women. Like, that was set out in stone. There was no ifs or buts. I had a really clear idea that, you know, going back to the equality is not sameness, I wanted to do something that made it attractive and easy for women to want to engage with their finances.
Yeah.
And I knew that I definitely did not want to be the type of financial advisor sitting in front of a businessman with him saying, sell it to me. I didn't want to be on that beauty parade. I was like, that is not what I want my life to be. Mm-hmm. I want to help people. I want to work with people who genuinely need and want me. And so that's where the divorcing women side of things came from, is knowing the value that I can add to those women. And at this point, I was in my 40s and a lot of my close friendships were starting to, and, you know, I think 40s is a common time for divorces to happen. So Willowbrook started in October 2019 and it started for women divorcing. It started originally for women. Before it even launched, it was for women who were divorcing.
Okay.
And then it just gradually evolved. And each step of the way as it was evolving, it was very much led by what I was being presented with. And so fairly soon after I launched, I got unbelievably busy. Like, I couldn't cope busy, and I knew I had to do something different, and I really had to step back and think about the clients that I was working with and the ones that I was adding the most value to. And I also had to think about how I preserved myself within this journey, because there were a group of women for whom there was no solution. And this is really hard message to get out there, but there are where there is not enough money to go around, there is often no solution. There is pain. And I couldn't charge those women. I felt that they were already in a financial situation that was a huge hardship. And while my advice would be valuable in terms of some guidance, I couldn't actually fix the problem. Whereas there was this other group of women where there was more wealth involved, where I didn't carry the burden of worrying about the fact that we couldn't fix the problem. I knew we could fix it. Mm-hmm. Plus, I knew that my specific skills were just so spot on to helping her get this exactly how she needed it. And so I introduced a minimum level that I worked with. And it was really hard because I am not from a wealthy background. You know, I'm a working class girl. So I was very much closing the door on the working class women. Mm. And the way that I've been able to kind of cope with that and be able to be at peace with that is that I offer a day a month for those clients free of charge. So I do a day a month that is pro bono, no charges, that I just kind of get in the nitty gritty of what's going on in those types of divorces. And that's important because I still want to help, but I know that I cannot carry the weight of that help as my journey, as kind of my business. So that's how I moved into working with women divorcing wealthy men. I have a background. What happened in work was very much linked to narcissism, the reason that I left. And I won't go into that story, but that started to show up for me in working with these wealthy women. Mm. And actually constantly, like every client I was talking to, it weren't just wealthy women. They were women who had powerful husbands, husbands who were displaying toxic personality traits. And I started to kind of move into more women divorcing wealthy and powerful men. And very much at that point, improving my own knowledge and experience around narcissism became key. So I did some training on that from a perspective to have the expertise in how I should manage myself and support the client. So not training as in how I counsel the client. You know, mm-hmm. I'm not a narcissism coach or therapist, but I knew that I needed a skill set. If these women were divorcing these type of men, they needed to be able to turn to me and know that I knew the tactics and the strategy and was able to communicate and understand where they were. And I also did some financial abuse training around that time because that was showing up a lot with my clients, the control of money. So things continued to evolve. And it got to the point where literally every client who rang me, I could almost write what they were going to tell me.
Wow.
And they were all different in that obviously they all have their personal stories and I treat them all as individuals. But like 99% of the time they would say to me, he's a CEO or he's just becoming a CEO or he's a step before and we're going to find out about him being a CEO really soon. And we've been traveling the world, but we've come back to the UK and we've got these late teen children and they're going off to university and I'm now back in the UK and I have no support system and I lost all my contacts and I wasn't working. And, you know, the story was just very similar. And I was like, that's just the universe calling to me because every client is saying this. And I became a real specialist in how those CEOs get paid and how their finances look. And it's really specific. They have these types of payment plans, long-term incentive payment plans that pay out in a certain way based on performance over a number of years. And it's really complex when it comes to divorce because it could mean that you're divorcing now, but they're due some payments in the future that relate to you were married. And so
then you've got to do a bit of modeling, haven't you? A bit of present values and future cash flows and all of that. Yeah,
absolutely. So I just got to the point where when you've worked with so many women in the same situation, you really do know the things that could be coming up for them and become a real specialist in it. And that's where I am now. And I don't know if it will evolve further. There's nothing that's obvious in my path just now that says it's going to evolve. You know, I'm very much still getting the same types of clients and I'm not seeing a huge difference in that. So this may be where we stay. We'll see. We'll see how it progresses.
Wow, Kerry, you've said so much in that that is both inspiring, illuminating. When you talk about some of the experiences, you know, I was literally gripped by your every word with regard to, you know, the commonality in the stories that you hear from prospective clients about their experiences. And actually, even as you were speaking, a couple of Rainmakers came to mind who'd had very similar experiences with regard to maybe having moved overseas as what they call quote unquote trailing spouses, and then finding that when they return to the UK, they feel almost rudderless, you know, not having exactly as you described, not having a support system. And then suddenly the marriage dissolves and you're left feeling completely helpless. And, you know, lots of those women then trying to rebuild themselves in all of the different ways, of course, not least financially, but from many different perspectives, training for, into a new career, thinking about what they'd like to do next if they've been out of the workplace for a long time. So there are all of these sorts of things. And one thing that you said, which is a thing that again comes up with me with the, within the Rainmaker community, is treading that line between, obviously, my role in providing kind of coaching and guidance is quite different from the very specialist financial planning that you'd be doing with your clients, particularly for that niche. But the thing that is common across both is that, you know, when you're engaging, particularly with women, and I always say I love women, my preference will always be to sit in a group of women and have a good chat and have a good gossip than it would be to sit alone in a group of men. And I think, you know, that's one of the great joys for me in doing this work and within the Rainmaker community. But I always think you've got to tread that line between being respectful of your clients' boundaries and also the fact that in the example that you gave, obviously you've trained in some of the different areas that, you know, themes that keep coming up. So you talked about narcissism, you talked about financial abuse, but thinking about, you know, the fact that sometimes there is a need for an actual psychotherapist to be involved in some of these discussions too, and not wanting to cross that line. How do you make sure, because this is something that comes up for me quite often, where I'm thinking about exactly as you described, I need to preserve the integrity of our relationship as me being somebody that is trying to provide guidance around personal finance, as well as provide a bit of comfort and reassurance that absolutely, you know, you have all of the abilities and everything that you need, all of the competence that you need to really transform your finances and take them to the next level. But at the same time, not overstepping, because of course that could potentially be a detriment to both the client and to my own well-being. How do you navigate that, Kerry?
I think what is to my advantage is the growing understanding that when you get divorced, there's three people you really need on your side. Mm-hmm. It's your legal team, it's your financial team, and it's your emotional team.
Okay.
So when I meet with a client in the first instance, we'll explore who those people are. I'm sometimes the very first person they reach out to. Mm. And that's because their ex is often saying, let's not get a solicitor involved, let's keep it amicable. And there's almost a pressure on them to not get a solicitor involved.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I think you always need a solicitor. Doesn't mean that you're not going to be amicable, it just means that you're going to do some due diligence. Doesn't mean that you're going to go to court, you could do it through mediation, you could do it around the table with him, but you need a solicitor to have that sense check and be able to confirm that what you're doing sits with what the outcome, or in the realms of what the outcome should be. So when I meet with a client for the first time, I will explore who's that support team around them. I'll make suggestions if they don't have a legal team and suggest some that would fit. And similarly, emotionally, I know a lot of divorce coaches and therapists, and we'll explore who might be appropriate. I specifically will also then give them a list of people to follow on Instagram. I think it's a really marvelous thing to do, to have your Instagram set up so that when you're looking at it, it's giving you words of encouragement and little tidbits of knowledge and things. So even if they don't reach out to an emotional coach, which they don't all, they're following some of them on Instagram and being able to get support that way as well. So if that's if I'm the first person contacted, but often I will get clients via divorce coaches. So I know in those instances, they're working really closely with a divorce coach.
Brilliant.
And then while we're in the journey, I think one of the things that we really need to do is hold space for clients when they have those emotional elements coming up. You know, money is linked very closely to fear and insecurity and control. And there's so many emotions that can come up as we talk through it. And I recognize that I don't have to be the one who emotionally supports the client, but I am there in that space to hold them and to make sure that they do have the right support around them following the meetings. And to share, you know, I will often share with clients other clients' stories as words of inspiration, as words of guidance, so that they can see that there is a way forward and that they're not the only ones who find themselves in that position. Because I think that's one of the big things. There's this real belief with my clients that they have made a mistake in the way that they have chosen to do things, and there's regret and there's a sense of having been a fool in hindsight, and that absolutely doesn't ring true. There's so many reasons why they find themselves where they find themselves, and absolutely none of it is their fault.
Mm. Yeah, definitely those feelings, you know, owning those feelings of guilt or regret or I've done the wrong thing, that's certainly something that can plague so many of us. So yeah, really good advice. And one thing that you touched on was with regard to when these initial conversations are happening about divorce, and, you know, as a woman, we may feel under pressure from our male partners to do things a certain way. We may be influenced a certain way at our own expense in lots of cases. And so I suppose for anybody listening, and particularly given the time of year that this podcast will be released, and I know that Christmas or any kind of festive, you know, any, I guess, holiday season, but particularly around Christmas, that can be a time that's fraught with difficulty in relationships and really unearth perhaps some issues that you've tried to bury and have been unsuccessful in doing so. And then there are, I always know that there is a spike in divorce cases in January. You can correct me if I'm wrong on that, Kerry.
No, there is.
And so for any woman that's listening to this podcast, what should be the right order? Because, of course, as I say, there is the emotional devastation. If there are children involved, you're thinking about that too. But what would you say is the right order? So actually, you've given a really nice trio, if you like, of different types of experts that should be involved. Is there an appropriate order that people should be going to their legal team, the financial team, the emotional team?
So I think actually reaching out to an emotional coach first is a really good move.
Okay.
The first thing that I would like to say, though, is that scenario where you have decided to separate and your ex is really saying, let's do this amicably, and it's almost becoming a weapon, you know, because that's one of the big concerns that I have around amicable divorce, is this way that it can be manipulated so that if you try to do anything that they don't agree with, then you're the one who is trying to make things less amicable. So let's talk about that just briefly, because I think it plays in. And so on that point, you can do these things confidentially. There is absolutely no reason you should have to, but if you know it may trigger your spouse, you can go and get emotional, financial and legal support without letting them know, if you have access to finances. And that's the key thing, because if they're controlling money, then you may need to have a conversation with them around how you're going to have access to funds during this separation. But you can do these things confidentially. You don't have to let them know that you're getting this kind of advice. And I think it's absolutely vital that you do, because it's due diligence. And you should never just agree to something that your ex tells you is a fair deal, because in the long run, they generally don't have your best interests at heart. That isn't normally their priority by that point. So in terms of the order, emotional, I think, is a good place to start, because you can start to consider the things that are most pressing around the children, typically around how you're going to have certain conversations and just about how you might approach your financial planner or your solicitor. Those can be two really scary things to do. You may have an impression of a financial planner because you didn't work with one, or just what we think financial planners are. And similarly, a solicitor, you might kind of have a feeling that it's going to be quite a corporate and quite a formal relationship. And so speaking to a divorce coach in the lead up to meeting those individuals can really help reassure you. They probably know lots of us and are able to tell you that we're just normal people and that we're just really trying to help, and that all of those reassurances and knowing the connections can certainly help. That said, if you happen to call a divorce financial planner or solicitor first, we will do the same. You know, I will have that same kind of holding conversation, make sure you know about a solicitor and an emotional coach, and make sure you're getting that support there as well. If you are going to choose a direction, that's kind of the route I would go. I'd go emotional coach and then the solicitor and the financial planner about the same time. We would, in terms of kind of how our roles differ, because that can be confusing for people, the solicitor is going to be the one who is able to say what the precedent is here, what you legally what they think this outcome should look like and actually take those steps. The financial planner is going to be the one who works out what you actually need, how much and for how long, what the finances would look like in different situations. What the financial planner does doesn't necessarily mean that's what you're going to get. It's kind of the foundations so that you then have the right information to share with your solicitor to then assess whether or not that's a realistic outcome to get in your divorce.
Okay. Yeah, no, that makes sense. That's super clear. Thank you so much for that. And I suppose one of the things that it occurs to me, and it's a thing that I, you know, we've had conversations about in the Rainmaker community, is about the just sheer fatigue that comes with divorce or any kind of, you know, these huge milestones that we experience in our lives. So whether it's becoming a mom for the first time, it might be going through a bereavement, but certainly divorce is one of those instances where alongside everything else, there's just the sheer fatigue. And I know, you know, you've talked about being influenced by a partner potentially to go down an amicable route, because of course it may be in their best interests more so than our best interests, you know, as the female partner. And it strikes me that that fatigue can mean that it's easy for us to become quite blinkered in our thinking, or perhaps to be quite traditional in our thinking, I suppose is another way of saying it, and to view certain assets in a divorce situation as the main assets. You know, this is the golden egg when it comes to, you know, if we have to separate, then I want the comfort of having this particular asset because this will soften things. It will make my life easier over the long term, and it will make the transition for the children easier over the long term too. And for me, you know, based on some of the conversations I've had, it's all roads point towards the house, particularly for women, you know, and I say this anecdotally, you'll be able to shed more light on this, but, you know, in lots of the conversations I've overheard and articles I've read for lots of women, we want to keep the house because we think, you know, I don't want to uproot the children. I don't want to uproot myself. I've got a sense of community here and stability. And as a result, it can mean that we overlook potentially other types of assets, which might include pension schemes. You've talked about long-term incentive plans as well. What would you say, when we're thinking about the equitable division of assets over the long term, is this something that you see coming up time and time again with women? I mean, what are some of the mistakes you would say that women, you'd like women to avoid when it comes to this conversation?
Yeah. So I think there's three parts to your question there. So the last bit there, what are the stakes? But also you touched on how weary and how much of a workload. Possibly. And then you also touched on if he wants it amicable and in his best interest. So I just want to cover those first two bits because they're important. So an amicable divorce is always best for everyone and for the children. And if you can avoid the court system, then do. The court system is falling. It is full. It takes on average 56 weeks to go from the start of a court process to the end.
Wow.
That's a huge, huge burden to carry, and the costs are significant and the emotional toll. So if you can keep it amicable, let's keep it amicable 100%. The key though is that you do your due diligence while you're keeping it amicable. So you have somebody that you sense check things with, your lawyer who can tell you whether or not what you're agreeing. So the amicable routes are things like going through mediation, where you would actually sit with your ex either over Zoom or face to face and talk through how you both see this playing out, get some disclosure, make sure you understand the finances. You'll probably be involved with a financial planner then, because you want to really understand the finances, and then you come to an agreement. And if you can do that and get as far as you can on that, and then maybe you can't do the last bit and you need to kind of get some legal intervention there, that's still a lot better than if you just go straight down a court route or a legal route. So that was the first thing. The second thing about being weary, I often say that divorce is like having a second job. It is a lot of work, particularly if you are going through that court system. It is a weight, and you need to be prepared for that and willing to be open to the time and the effort that that's going to take, because your future financial security is very much dependent. So decisions shouldn't be made just because you want to end the process. And that's actually a tactic that is often used by the type of men my clients are divorcing. They will drag things out and drag things out in the hope that they will get to the point where their partner has just lost the will and they give up. And so it's knowing that that could happen and having the right support team around you and having the emotional tools and guidance to be able to be resilient in that process. Then the last part, which is the important part that you had there at the end, around what are the key things that are coming up where clients potentially are blinkered, maybe because of the weariness, maybe because of emotional reasons about what they should do. So specifically the home, you're right. It is a natural thing to want to create stability during a time of chaos, and divorce is chaos. And so keeping the home stable for the children, particularly if they have exams, if they've had this separation, you want to make things as comfortable for them as possible. And that often is the approach that a woman takes, and often it's the right approach. I think we need to acknowledge that, and it's really important that women don't go around thinking, if I take the house, I've made a mistake.
Good point.
The point is, you need to know the difference between taking the house and taking the pension share. And they're normally the two assets. It might be investments, but you need to know. You need to know if I did this one or I did that one. And specifically what you need to know is, what will my income be now and what will my income be in retirement in scenario A and scenario B? Scenario A, let's imagine she keeps the family home and forgoes a pension share. And so we know what her income is going to be now, and we know that she's not going to have enough income in retirement. What we can do is then model if she downsizes and effectively releases enough money to then make the difference for the pension share that she didn't get.
Right.
And so that can sometimes work, often can work for clients, particularly where there is sizable equity in a property. So I have a client yesterday, and the property that she's currently living in is worth around 650. And when she downsizes, it'll be worth around 350. So she's got around 300,000 tied up in her property that ultimately is going to be used for her retirement. And she knows how much she's going to have if we invest that money, and when we invest that money, what the averages will be and how what her income looks like. So just to kind of double back on that, what you need to be able to do is say, if I take scenario A or scenario B, I know what my income is now and my income is in retirement. I know if I have a shortfall, how I could make that up. If you've got that information, you can make that decision from an informed place. And that comes up with many things. So yeah, I would say property is the main one that comes up there. That's the main kind of thing that women tend to priority.
I love that. That's super helpful, particularly the way that you have provided, you know, this practical way of evaluating these different scenarios, which I think can provide that much needed clarity. And I suppose where you don't have that clarity yourself, and few of us do, particularly at a time like that, then this is where your financial planner really can help, you know, provide you with that, you know, that guidance and support. So brilliant. Thank you. So I suppose taking several steps back then, before we even get to a point of divorce, before we even get married, what do you wish more women knew when they were entering into a marriage? What sorts of money conversations should we be having? Are there any, rather than saying red flags, what are the green flags we should be looking out for with our partner? Yeah. You know, what are some of the more positive hallmarks of success from a financial perspective when it comes to two people that are about to fuse their lives together and, of course, their finances?
So I think there are a lot of indicators. So if you're early dating, you can start to get a feel for how your potential other half thinks about money. You know, are they ordering a pizza or are they taking you to the most lavish restaurant? Is their idea of a holiday backpacking around Thailand, or are they expecting to go, you know, kind of five-star hotels all the way? So you'll start to get a feel for how they spend their money. And those kind of little indications are kind of, you know, what do they do around birthdays? Are they open? Are they talking to you about how much they earn? Are they talking to you about how much they save? Before you move in with somebody, you absolutely have to have the money conversation, because you're right, your finances are going to become entwined. So before you move in with somebody, you need to very, very much be talking to them about what debt they have, what savings they have, and what their future financial goals are. That's an absolute given and a conversation that needs to be open and then held continuously. If you're going into a relationship with somebody and they reveal that they've got £60,000 worth of debt, that is a chance for you to really step back and think, okay, this person really has handled money very differently to me, and how might that impact our future happiness, and what are the reasons for them having that debt, and how do I feel about that becoming part of my journey? So that's a really key thing. Now, going forward, you know, you've had that conversation with them. You need to then talk about how you view life and how you view it financially. You know, what are some key things that you want to be able to do? The very practical thing you need to do, though, is talk about how you're going to split your finances. One of you might earn a lot more than the other, and you need to make a decision about what you think is fair. For some people, it just means that you just split all the bills 50-50. And for others, it's proportionate. You know, if they're earning five times the amount you are, then you may pay 20%, they may pay 80%, because that leaves you both with the same kind of level of net disposable income. So you need to work out and agree what that looks like and how you're going to communicate that to each other. You know, how are you going to communicate if you're buying a big purchase? How would you feel if your partner came home and said, oh, I've just spent £20,000 on a new car? Is that a kind of conversation you'd expect to have had? And what are your boundaries? So you almost need to have like a contract around, not what was formed as a contract, but just a conversation around, what are our boundaries here? What do we think we should be telling each other? When should we be getting each other involved? How much money should we each have left? What should we do with money? What are we using money for? And then that conversation needs to be ongoing and open in front of your children as often as possible. You know, if our children can grow up hearing us talk about money, they are going to be so much savvier than we ever were. And I don't know why money is such a taboo. You know, it is not against the law for your children to know how much you earn.
But no.
It's important. They need context. They need to understand how much bills are. They need to understand how their mum and dad talk about money, because it's a really good example of how they want their relationships around money to be with their spouse as well. Have I covered it? I think I did. I went around the
houses. You have, not only have you covered it, but you've given me a perfect opportunity for me to talk about why I wrote Cash is Queen, because absolutely that last part of what you said, and it's interesting that it's come up in the context of what do you wish, you know, my question was, what do you wish more women knew before they got married, and what sorts of things they should they be looking out for in terms of, you know, forging a successful financial relationship? And I think the thing that's interesting is that we can sometimes, as parents especially, we can become quite, on the face of it, it may look like we're obsessed with our children, but we actually become quite self-obsessed, and we think, oh, well, I can't tell them this, and I can't show them that, and I can't expose them to this experience or that experience because they're too young. And then what happens is time moves on so quickly. There is no parent alive that hasn't said, oh my gosh, they've grown so fast. Or they see, you know, someone else's child. And we say that time moves on so quickly. So all the time we're waiting for the right opportunity to introduce some of these topics. The next thing we know, our children have grown up and they've moved out. And we lost our opportunity to, from our own perspective, to share with them perhaps some of the mistakes we made, whether they are financial or otherwise. And to help steer and navigate them, to humanize ourselves, because I think we do this thing where we become so detached from the realities of being an adolescent or a small child and feel like, oh, well, I don't want to burden them with that, or I don't want them to be stressed about it. When actually, you know, particularly when it comes to money, children already know so much more than we think. And I think it's our responsibility to make sure that we are educating them in the right way and giving them accurate information, rather than having them rely upon hearsay, maybe standing at the top of the stairs and listening to an argument and thinking, oh my God, like what's going on with mom and dad, or whatever it may be. And so really, so thank you, because, you know, when I was writing Cash is Queen, that was really one of the things in my mind, was how can we make sure that young women, before they enter adulthood, already know their way around the basics? We can't have these generations of young girls becoming teenagers, leaving home. You know, we had a brilliant debate on Instagram just yesterday. This is a slight tangent, but related. But we had a brilliant debate on Instagram yesterday on the Rain Check page about, and it was inspired by something I'd seen on another account about some of the mistakes, the money mistakes we made as young women, particularly around consumerism and buying clothes and shoes and all of those sorts of things. And all of the store cards that they were flinging out at us, you know, in the early 2000s, I would say, all of our favorite shops, you know, Oasis, Topshop, Miss Selfridge, they all had these store cards that were horrific. And we all signed up for them as students. Like, we were working probably 2 days a week because we were studying. We still had these credit cards and we had no idea. We wouldn't even have viewed them as credit cards. We wouldn't have viewed it as debt. And so it's these sorts of things that we want to be able to share with our children, and which I talk about in the book, actually, about this is what debt looks like. This is how to avoid it. And exactly as you describe, even in your friendship group as a young woman, start to look out for differing behaviours. And it doesn't necessarily mean, obviously, good behaviours or bad behaviours or negative behaviours mean that that person is a bad person, but it's just being able to protect yourself and to guard your own financial well-being by saying, actually, I'm not going to do that. And perhaps being a leader in your group of friends, you know, it's a hard thing to do as a teenager, but I think it's a much easier prospect if you've got the knowledge and the backing either of your parents or of another resource, a book or something that is saying, these are some of the principles that you should follow instead.
100%.
So yeah, thank you so much for that. And I think, you know, I suppose my next question, thinking about as women, when we get into these relationships, and I love that you talked about what kinds of dates might you go on and what kinds of travel taste, because I'm sure, you know, there were certainly clues when I think about my ex-husband and how different we were. I'm somebody that was always quite, certainly, I don't want to say more disciplined, but certainly somebody that was more budget focused.
Yeah.
And he was five star. And I think, you know, some of these differences that you don't necessarily interrogate too much, you know, when you're so besotted, you're walking around with hearts in your eyes, you can't really see some of these things. And so I hope that anybody who is listening to this that is walking around with the hearts in their eyes can just be mindful, not that they expect in their relationship to end in divorce, but more. And hence why I asked that question about what are the green flags to look out for and how can you start to steer things if you feel like actually we're veering slightly off course and there is a way to kind of gently become more aligned. But I think as a woman, when you enter these relationships, Kerry, what would you say that based on your experience is a thing that you see us overlooking, ignoring, not paying close enough attention to when we enter? So if you think about our individual personal finances, what are some of the things that you think as women we should be saying, oh, actually, I must make sure that, I don't know, I continue to pay into my pension or I don't know. Do you know what I mean?
100% know what you mean. And yes, on the pension, you should. So I think there are a number of reasons why women become disconnected with their finances during marriage. And I think financial services have got a lot to answer for, because I think part of that reason is the culture and the ethos and the way that financial services is portrayed by the media. If you want to be interested in money, we read about it being about performance and investing and how one particular asset has done better than another asset. And realistically, we don't use or portray the terms that we know women value when it comes to money. And so it can become a really natural part of a marriage where, because of how financial services and the media portray that side of things, because of how traditional financial advice works, it can become quite a masculine field. And your husband might just enjoy it, find it more interesting. And you're just thinking, well, at least he's spinning one Lincoln plate. Mm. Got all these plates over here. He's got one going. Crack on.
Yes.
Yeah. And there is this kind of sense of, well, I trust him. He's my husband. He's interested in it. I'm not. Leave him to it. That is a real issue. It's a real issue because it means then that you are not involved in the long-term financial planning decisions of the family. It means that you're not building your investment knowledge. It means that you're not having a chance to have an input on the long-term financial goals. And that actually you're losing touch with, or maybe not even having any touch with, how your overall finances look. It is sometimes felt that because you manage maybe the day-to-day household and the money, that side of things, that there isn't financial abuse. But if you don't have that picture of the longer term view and that input, that could also be seen as financial abuse. And where there is no financial abuse, you know, if it's just kind of a straightforward marriage and it's just fallen into those roles, which it very, very often does in the most amicable of marriages, where it is that situation, there are a couple of things that really need to change. One, financial services really needs to change and wake up. And two, you need to go and find financial planners who talk about what your money can do to help you create the life that you want to live. When you can link your money to the things that you value, which are often your children, your home. It's often about the opportunities you can create and the security you can create. When you can link money and finances to that, it becomes alive and it starts to make sense. And that's the type of financial planner you should have in your life. Those that are able to do that for you so that it doesn't feel like a task that he's owning. It just feels like a really important part of your life that you are working towards X, Y, or Z goal.
Super clear. I'm just thinking about that premarital stage. And one of the things that you touched on with regard to some of the money conversations you might be having in the household, whether you're at the relationship stage or when you enter into marriage, it's almost like forming a contract. It's a very informal contract, and nobody will want to describe it as such because it can, you know, makes it sound way more formal than it needs to be. But it is important. And I think by using that term, it lends itself to the significance of what it is that you're actually doing. And I almost think, you know, there's so much power, particularly having had my experience, as I say, of being divorced, there is so much power that comes from having these open conversations and really understanding one another. So you know whether you're a good fit, so that you're not leaping into things purely with the hearts in your eyes, and that you know whether actually, can we make this work? You know, can I support this person in digging themselves out of whatever financial situation they're in? Or am I willing to do that? Do I have the capacity to do it? Do we have financial goals or long-term just life goals that are aligned or misaligned? And what can we do about that? You know, it's a really empowering conversation. But one of the things that I think can be quite polarizing, you know, there's this debate that there tends to be a resurgence in this topic, you know, every couple of years, but it's around prenups. And I hear from lots of the rainmakers, especially, who are like, you know, I'm not getting married unless I've got a prenup in place. I've also heard from rainmakers who've said, you know, I raised the topic of prenup and, you know, my partner was so mortified by it because he viewed it as a tool of mistrust and that I didn't have enough faith in the sanctity of our union. And it just got really heavy and I just abandoned the topic. But actually, I really secretly still wanted one. So as an expert, Kerry, what is your view of prenups? Because I know that they can be perhaps unfairly labelled as unromantic. And I know that in certain jurisdictions, perhaps they're not necessarily legally binding. But do you view them as, what is your view of them? Let me not put words in your mouth.
I believe that it is far better to make a decision about how things should be split when you are absolutely in love with the other person than on the other side of things. And so I think that they're a good idea. I think they need to cover a number of areas. They don't just need to cover what happens if you split. They need to also then go further and talk about, okay, how do we financially compensate if we decide to have children and one of us gives up our job?
Yes.
You know, what do we then think is fair? What do we think is fair in terms of the impact on that person's pension if they've had to give up their job to look after the children? Mm-hmm. And what do we think is fair in terms of how they would then rebuild their life post-divorce because they have had such a long time out of a career? So it's not just about writing a prenup that says if we divorce, we'll split everything 50-50. Mm-hmm. It's about really getting into those very emotional, scary things that can happen at a time when you still really love the other person. Because then if you do find yourself on the other side of things, you will have covered those eventualities and hopefully have a space where you are able to revisit and say, this is what we thought was fair, and be able to have a really decent conversation around it.
Yeah, that's brilliant. I love that. And I particularly love your point about it's far better to have these sorts of conversations when you're absolutely in love. Couldn't agree more, 100%. So I suppose, Kerry, just as we come to a close, my last couple of questions, and I'm thinking about, you know, what we've talked about, the huge upheaval that divorce brings emotionally, you know, financially and everything else. But I think for lots of women, there is also an opportunity for reinvention, isn't there? And whenever I say the word reinvention, I always get Madonna vibes in my mind. But do you know what I mean? It's this idea of we can suddenly, and it's terrifying, but equally, it can be supremely liberating to suddenly be in a situation where you are, for the first time, perhaps, no longer accountable to another person after many years of being in a relationship. Your value system might have changed. You have changed in terms of how you view yourself and your identity. And it feels like, you know, that it's a colossal weight, but it's also, as I say, it's a huge opportunity. So given that you've probably advised hundreds, if not thousands of women, what does success look like for you in terms of, you know, based on the women that you've worked with, do you have examples of how women have transformed themselves post-divorce and how having that solid financial infrastructure has helped with that?
Absolutely. I think you're right. Divorce is a chance to pause and reassess. Mm. And one thing that comes up with nearly every single client is what was important to you before changes. And you have this chance to reevaluate your priorities and what it you really want. And so I work with these wealthy women who have had 5-star holidays in the best of hotels, you know, really flying first class, really lavish lifestyles. And when it comes down to it, what they tell me is important to them is so different to that lifestyle. In fact, they often are looking for the opposite of that lifestyle. You know, they're looking for depth. They're looking for a place where they can add value. They're looking to be in a place that just has much more meaning. And so they all go on to do a variety of things. I think the key thing is when you know what your income is for the long term and you're able to make decisions based on that, you're able to be freer and do braver things. So I have clients who have, you know, not worked for decades, go out there and actually decide that they're going. I've got one client specifically who's gone out there and decided to start renovating properties, but on a really huge scale, and is having massive success. I have another client who has decided that they're going to become a divorce coach and use all of their skills and their knowledge and everything that they've been through and come out the other side. I think each person's journey is success in itself. Mm. You know, divorce is not a failure, and we need to stop viewing it as that. And what we see is these women blossom, who become who they truly should be. And even if it's in the most simplest way, living lives that are truer to themselves.
Oh my gosh, I love that. What a mic drop moment. Absolutely, couldn't agree more. So then my final question, Kerry, and given everything that we've talked about, all the work that you do, what Rain Check is all about, which is really helping women to reclaim this idea of wealth, to not feel that it is something that is alien to them, that is hugely masculine and something that they should feel guilty or embarrassed about. I always ask guests who come on this podcast, what does it mean to be wealthy to you? And of course, that can constitute anything from financial through to mental wealth. But what does it look like for you, Kerry?
Wealth to me is about having choices and freedom and peace. Having wealth enables you to pursue a life that is meaningful to you. And it opens up all sorts of doors. And that doesn't mean that you are rich. I see that as something being very different, but it means that you have enough so that you are secure and able to do brave things and go brave places.
Oh my gosh, I love that. I love the idea of the choices, the freedom and the peace, especially the peace. Absolutely. Oh, brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Kerry, 3 quick fire questions, which I'm going to pick at random. Okay. So the first one, you're hosting a dinner party. Who's there and why? Can be anyone, famous
Brené
or non-famous.
Brown's
Sorry?
Brené Brown is there. So Brené Brown, who I adore, yes. Is there. She's absolutely there. And a guy called Michael Singer, I don't know if you know him. He's written a book called The Untethered Soul. And really similar to Brené Brown in that Brené Brown talks a lot about emotional peace and Michael Singer talks an awful lot about your soul and your journey. So those two are definitely there. Billy Connolly, I would love to have her.
Wow.
That would be amazing. Yeah.
Okay, that sounds like a good party. Yeah. Okay, brilliant. What's one money lesson you learned early on that you swear by?
Oh, I grew up in a time when financial advisors would come door to door. It was like a really common thing in the UK.
Yes, my grandparents' generation
and my grandparents' generation all had financial advisors. You know, there were significantly more financial advisors at that point. So I grew up in a family that always saved for future events. Mm. And that became a real norm for me. And actually, kind of like my most recent example of this is on my 40th birthday, I had already decided we were going to Disney World and I'd been saving for a number of years.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
And we went, and it was, luckily it was pre-COVID. It was in, what would have been 2018, would have been 2018. And it was marvellous. And literally that pot of money came because I'd grown up in a family that saved for future events.
Oh my God, amazing. I love that. And I'm sure it makes the big events that you've saved for that much sweeter. Because you know you haven't indebted yourself for them. Okay, and my final question then, just leading on from that, if you've grown up in a family in which you were always saving for future events, then if money is no object, what would you blow the budget on completely spontaneously?
A swimming pool.
Oh, like that. Go hard or go home.
Absolutely. I have this vision, my son's 10, and I have this vision of him and his teenage mates wanting to hang out at our house because we've got the swimming pool. So I think that's what it really is, kind of keeping him close and being on the space that they're all in and having that bit more time with him.
That's nice. That's a nice thing to aspire to as well, that your children like you enough to want to stay around when they're teenagers. Yeah. Same. Absolutely. I have that vision for myself and my two daughters too. He is hoping. Kerry, thank you so much for your time today. Where can people find you if they want to work with you and find out more about you?
So I use Instagram an awful lot, so they can find me on there, Willowbrook Financial Planning. I am running an event in February that they'll see on Instagram.
Brilliant.
Which is going into Christmas and coming out into the new year is a time when people are likely to be thinking about divorce. Mm. And so I'm running an event with a solicitor in February where we're just giving you the answers, the things that you should know as you enter into the divorce. I've got some barristers coming along and it's going to be amazing. So that will all be on my Instagram. So go and find me there and you'll see all the details.
That does sound amazing. I'll be there too. Well, Kerry, thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your day.
And you. See you soon, Davina. Take care.
Bye. Hi everyone, Davinia here. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. If any of what you heard resonated and you'd like to find out more about how Raincheck is helping women all over the world build sustainable long-term wealth, then visit our website at raincheck.com and join the mailing list for more commentary, tips and opinion on how you can start taking steps to leveling up your financial well-being today. You can follow us on social media at Raincheck and don't forget to share, like, rate, review and subscribe. See you next time. Thank you.